You're on the Front Porch, where we tackle the tough issues facing West Virginia and Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. About 1 in 3 West Virginia college students need to take remedial classes, and that number is growing. We'll discuss why high school graduates in West Virginia aren't better prepared for college. Also, we'll break down the results of the Alabama Senate race. If a Democrat can win there, what does that mean for West Virginia's congressional races? I'm Scott Finn, Grand Poobah here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and joining us as always is Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And Jessie Troyan joins us again. She's a PhD economist working for the Free Market Cardinal Institute. Jessie, is it fair to say that you're the only PhD economist living in Pinch, West Virginia?
I would wager a grand sum of money on that.
So the pride of Pinch, Jessie Troyan is with us as well. The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather. Download the CGM app at iTunes or Google Play. There's a new report out showing that almost 1 in 3 West Virginia high school grads needs to take a remedial class of some sort when he or she arrives at our state colleges. In some counties, it's much worse. Get this, 61% of all Logan County high school grads who go to college have to take a remedial class. Jessie, I know you're really concerned about this. What's your take on those numbers?
Well, it's clear to me that when we're looking at a graduation rate statewide that's approaching 90%, and then we're seeing 1 out of every 3 college-bound West Virginia students coming in and having to take remedial courses, you don't need to be a math major to see that this isn't adding up.
So what do you think is going on there? You're kind of hinting that there's a correlation between the higher graduation rates from high school and the need for a lot of these young people to take remedial classes when they get to college.
I think that's a very fair claim to be made. In the Gazette article that spurred this conversation, you have one of the representatives, I believe it was from Greenbrier County, who was saying it appears that we have made it too easy to graduate, that when students are having to repeat courses or make something up, that we've made it too easy for them to gain the credits without actually learning.
And Rick, what's your take about what's going on? I know you've actually worked with young people in Logan County. What do you think?
There's a crisis going on in a lot of West Virginia, with not just with addiction, but with really bad economy. Poverty takes up a lot of bandwidth. Behavioral economists who've studied that have talked about that, that if you have a lot of stressors in your life, it's kind of hard to concentrate. So, I mean, I think that's obviously a part of it. And it's interesting, there's not a lot of analysis. I downloaded the report. It's mostly just sort of just the facts, man. But Chris Treadway, who compiled it, told the Gazette, what you're seeing is socioeconomic conditions that students face are a strong predictor of college success.
Well, I certainly think that the socioeconomic factors are something that we shouldn't ignore. However, that's bringing into the discussion a much bigger question of what's going on throughout West Virginia.
There's some good news. I mean, we do have a pretty high school graduation rate of almost 90%, which is up. So that's part of it. And also, I've been talking with a member of the Higher Education Policy Commission, Coralie Dennison. He used to also work at Marshall, and they've been working really hard on this idea of having what they call co-requisite courses. In other words, these are courses when you arrive at college, if you need a remedial class, it also counts as credit. They combine introductory courses and remedial courses. So at the very least, these young people who arrive there and have to take remedial classes have to pay for those, and in the past they got no credit for it. And it led to much higher dropout rates. So they're trying to deal with it in that way. But, you know, what's the diagnosis then? What do you think we need to be talking about doing to, you know, make sure that when young people get to college, they actually don't need to take remedial classes?
I mean, first, the good news, we even have people trying to pursue post-secondary education, something we desperately need in this state. And the fact that you have to take remedial class doesn't mean that you're an absolute failure. You're not going to make it either. It just means there are things you didn't make up for. But you used to live in a lot of poor counties. You know there are huge inequalities between county school systems. I'm not going to name county names, but I remember at one point seeing an honors high school book that was an elementary school book in another county. But there's a new book by Sarah Goldrick Rabb called Paying the Price, where she did longitudinal studies of college students. She mostly focused in Wisconsin. And people have an image of college students as like living on campus, having a great time, being supported by the parents. That's really not true. Most are working right now. Some have no food security. She tells the story of someone who dozed off in her classroom, and she asked what was wrong, thinking she was a slacker, and she'd worked all night. And there's all these things going on with college students, many of whom are actually supporting their families, contrary to the stereotype.
I used to work at the University of South Florida in Tampa. It's not a fancy school. There are a lot of first-generation college students that go there. And they were having horrible trouble with retention. In other words, young people go there and then they drop out before they can finish their degree. And they did a study, and the people at the college had these ideas about what might be going on. People assume that kids go there and they party too much and then they drop out because of that. And obviously that's always a factor. But what they found was the biggest factor was economics. Young people were trying to work too many hours outside of school and still be able to go to school, so they couldn't do their classes correctly, and they'd fail the classes, and then they'd still have to pay for that. It becomes this sort of rolling thing.
This is the most heavily indebted generation probably ever, and they're going into, they're not going into a good workforce situation. They might still be in low-paying jobs, and if they get behind the eight ball, then they're stuck with unpaid student loans, which get in their way of everything else. It's a raw deal for that generation of students.
And so the whole point of that is that's why remedial classes are not great, because it's already too expensive and takes too long to graduate from college. And if you have to take remedial classes, you are much more likely not to make it. Doesn't mean that you can't. And I'm not saying there shouldn't be remedial classes. I'm just saying the lower we can get that number, the better off young people will be. So Jesse, what's your diagnosis? What should we do about this?
Well, I think one of the first things that we need to take into consideration is what have we prioritized in West Virginia as our metric of success? I think a pretty strong case can be made here that we've prioritized graduation rates. And so we've fallen under this way of thinking where what gets measured becomes what is important. I'm sure a bunch of your listeners may be familiar with The Office. And you have all of these different bosses that are over top of the main character. And what he's trying to do is just keep the next guy up off of his back. And there's probably an argument to be made here that as a policy prescription, we have said, hey, let's focus on our graduation rates. And in doing so, yeah, we've boosted them up, but to what end? It's great if we're graduating high school students, but if they're not prepared, what is that saying about our school system as a whole?
My take on it as a former teacher is that we need to do a better job of making sure young people in high school, when they graduate, know where they're really at. In other words, are you ready for what you want to do? And so what you really don't want, it happens way too often, is for young people to go to college, get in over their heads, spend a lot of money, and fail. And so that's a failure of our high school system.
I spoke to a teacher in my family about this issue, and she went off right away that, about participation points. If you're passing people along who aren't really quite ready, that's a problem too. And I think that's something that the delegate from Greenbrier County is making a point. Since you mentioned The Office, I think there are obviously underlying issues of updog here.
Updog? Updog. I have no idea. Rick, get
why don't you say what's up, dog?
What's up, dog?
Not much. What's up with you? You remember that on The Office? Were you a fan?
I'm remembering it much more than the pieces of flair. Or
that's what she said or whatever. But like I go to meetings and I say, I'm going to updog somebody today. And so you just work updog into the conversation, praying that someone will say, you act like it's a thing. Like, well, there's structural updog over there. I smell updog. Actually, I live for that. That's the only thing that keeps me going.
I assume when you said that there was some deeper meaning, but no.
It's all about updog.
What's updog?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And by the way, it's not The Office, is it? It's Office Space. Right?
I was thinking of the TV.
That's correct.
I was thinking of this. You mentioned, I was thinking of the TV series, The Office.
I thought of the TV series, but Jesse's talking about the movie, The Office. I'm like, oh, I've missed something. Maybe that the young people, like Jesse.
Kids these days watch.
Yeah, this is my mistake. My movie trivia is usually pretty terrible once I get outside of The Godfather.
I only have two movies, really. It's Wayne's World and The Big Lebowski, so... And Enter the Dragon.
Well, we know Rick. Rick, you're an open book, but The Godfather, Jesse? That's interesting.
It is. Part of it is I found on a family member's bookshelf the Mario Puzo novel. So I read the book first and then got into the movies, aside from the fact that a bunch of my friends in college were, oh my gosh, this is such a great movie. This is a classic. You have to watch it.
I love that. Reading The Godfather in West Virginia. Thank you both for that great conversation. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll break down the results of the Alabama Senate race. If a Democrat can win there, what does that mean for West Virginia? But first...
Hi, I'm Roxy Todd, reporter and co-producer for Inside Appalachia. When I think back on the past 12 months, one of my favorite moments was when I was recording a story with Scott Shriver, who discovered a rare orchid in Pocahontas County.
We are in a grassy area between the side of the road and the boreal forest that is common to the highlands of West Virginia. I think there's stuff in the nooks and crannies of West Virginia that no one's ever seen or described before, and that's exciting.
I wonder how many little-known wonders there are waiting to be discovered inside these mountains, and what we'll uncover next year. As we approach the end of the year, I just want to say thank you from all of us at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you'd like to make a donation in honor of someone you love, look for the red Donate Now button on wvpublic.org. Thanks, and happy holidays.
Okay, we're back, and we're talking about the Alabama Senate race and what it means for West Virginia. Actually, West Virginia had a higher margin for Donald Trump than Alabama did.
Because we're whiter.
But it's interesting to think about it that way. People say, you know, talk about Alabama as being this deep red state where a Democrat could win. Well, West Virginia is apparently a deeper red state, at least at the presidential level. And yet Joe Manchin, our senator, is a Democrat, has managed to hang on. He's in a tough race this year. I guess my first question is, does the Democratic win in the Alabama Senate race, does that have any analog to our Senate race or are there congressional races? Or do you think it's a one-off? Rick?
I think we're so far apart geographically and culturally and that you can't really generalize what's going to happen from that.
I would be hesitant to call it so much of a Democratic win in Alabama as it was just such a terrible choice of a candidate on the margins of character. And perhaps in light of the conversation that we had about Harvey Weinstein the last time I was on here, that character still matters in politics, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary elsewhere, that there is still some feedback mechanism in place, regardless of how imperfect we tend to think it works.
I'll tell you guys, I don't know if you know this, we got a little bit of pushback from our talk about Harvey Weinstein, and it's because of my headline. That's my fault. I put a headline on the story that said, "Who is West Virginia's Harvey Weinstein?" You know, on social media, people don't listen to the podcast all as much as I would like. Yeah, you know, shockingly. Instead, what they do is they look at the headline and they just start riffing off of that. And so we had a combination of people who are trying to like tarnish other people, like I know who the Harvey Weinstein is. And we had to block a lot of those because we don't do libel on our Facebook site or any of our stuff. And then also we had a lot of people that rightfully so said, well, what are you doing here? I mean, you're just trolling for someone to talk about this. But I think what the conversation was, no, so not to tarnish you two, that's my fault. The conversation was really more about where is West Virginia's Harvey Weinstein? Why hasn't it shown up yet in West Virginia at this sort of level? Not speculating on who it is, but assuming that, you know, we all hear these stories about sexual harassment. We all know it happens. And yet you haven't had the Me Too movement force the resignation of a well-known statewide figure yet. Seeing what happened in Alabama with Roy Moore, do you think it's going to have an effect on West Virginia culture in that way?
I think the Moore case was so over the top that it kind of, the question as far as politics for regardless of where you are is how nihilistic do you want to be? What are you willing to tolerate? Like someone who with a record of being a sexual predator, is that worth it to get your bills passed? Well, is it worth a white supremacist, you know, to get your tax cuts, you know?
Alleged.
How nihilistic do we want to be?
Alleged child predator. I think, and when I get back in my...
I wouldn't not naming names, but if there were a proven child sexual predator who's going to vote your way and had a lot of money behind him, how low would you go? That's a question people got to face.
Well, and in public media, for some reason I can't quite put my finger on, we are chock-a-block full of people that are being accused of sexual harassment now. I mean, so many. We got Charlie Rose on PBS. We have Garrison Keillor. There's a guy called John Hockenberry that used to host The Takeaway, which we air here. Garrison Keillor in particular, though, man, we had a backlash. We did not drop Garrison Keillor from our schedule. He was already retired from A Prairie Home Companion, and we did this thing called The Writer's Almanac at noon that he hosted. Minnesota Public Radio, the people that make that, stopped producing it, and we have no choice about it. But the larger issue, people are just angry in general that someone that they loved to listen to is off the air. They don't know why. It hasn't been fully, you know, explored. And they think that these are becoming witch hunts. That's the mail I get from a lot of people, especially older viewers and listeners. So I'm going to put Jesse on the spot as the not so old one of us. Do you think there's a generational difference in how people are looking at these allegations?
I would say that there's probably a case for that. We see on college campuses and these different safe space ideas and the microaggressions. I could see where there's a strong case to be made that the younger generation, you know, my generation probably being included in that, takes a harder sort of zero tolerance type of stance to it. Whereas, you know, maybe my parents' generation is going to say, hey, there's no hard and fast evidence. Maybe he was a shady dude, but this is just business.
There's a great story in the Charleston Gazette Mail. They're not just our underwriter. They're a wonderful newspaper to subscribe to. But anyway, there's a story about the Republican National Committee members from West Virginia and their opinions on Roy Moore. Conrad Lucas, who's also running for Congress, is one of them. And he said, yes, I support Roy Moore. But he's kind of vague about why and whether he believed the women. Melody Potter was another RNC person from West Virginia, and she gave more detail. And she basically said that it would take some sort of forensic evidence or maybe a videotape for her to believe the allegations against Roy Moore. And so I guess it comes down to, you know, this isn't a court of law, you know, but there are consequences to these allegations. Should they be proved to a court of law standard before there are any consequences? Or is it okay to say, we don't have proof, but there's enough evidence for us to take action? What do you think, Rick?
This would be good to have Lori here, you know, with a legal background and things like that, because, I mean, I can see it's a deeply ingrained part of American tradition that no one should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process.
By the government.
By the government, right. And it doesn't apply everywhere. I'm just saying it's a value that people hold. And so I think some people say, well, yes, you should investigate every claim seriously, but investigate before there's some kind of official sanction. I think that's where a lot of people probably are.
My stance holds pretty much the same as I said on the last episode when the Matt Lauer allegations had come out. And as a business, as some sort of an entity with a brand, an image to protect, if you have a person on your staff who has displayed evidence of their character being contra what this brand is trying to be, represents to its public, that I think it's within the enterprise's self-interest to say, we want to sever ties with you because you tarnish the brand.
I strongly recommend you guys go back and look at our last podcast on that. We've renamed it, Where is West Virginia's Harvey Weinstein? Check it out. And, you know, if people know of someone, or, you know, if that you've experienced it yourself and you want to reach out to us, you know, shoot me an email. I'm at sfin@wvpublic.org or a tweet at RadioFin. Rick, you get the last word.
I had it and I lost it. Oh, yeah. Just remember, there's a rule. Listen before you troll.
Yeah. Listen to our show, the podcast, before you troll. But why would trolls do that anything? I mean, their whole point is to annoy you. So is it, oh, maybe you should listen so you can troll more effectively.
Yeah, if you want to be like an ethical troll, you know, or a nihilistic troll. You
know. I think, or effective troll.
Yeah.
Like, you know, how they say when you give someone feedback, constructive feedback, it's much better if you're specific with your criticism and praise. So if you want to be a good troll, listen to the entire podcast. Take notes. And then use that in your trolling. It'll be much more devastating to me, Rick, and to Jesse.
Martial arts saying, don't swing, strike.
And that's The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn with Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee and Jesse Troyan, guest host from the Free Market Cardinal Institute here in West Virginia. Thanks for listening.